Hey everyone, it's Space Cafe podcast time, and your host, Marcus. Hello, space nerds. Let's kick this Space Cafe off in the most mundane way possible, right here on Earth, in front of a TV screen. I was just watching Handmaid's Tale, you know, the streaming show. For those of you who have not seen it yet, Handmaid's Tale is a story about a dystopian America that no longer exists, now called Gilead. Yes, just like the pharmaceutical company that is currently in the race for the COVID-19 vaccine. No joke. But the story was already written in the 1980s. So, America is no more and is ruled by an authoritarian theocracy. With the exception of a select elite, most women are second-class citizens. I'm telling this because the story is so incredibly well told and because it's so incredibly plausible. It is a story about life and survival, about environmental chaos and social reorganization. In short, it's a story about a new beginning, which admittedly is a very dark one. What our real world and this series have in common, in my opinion, is the awareness that things cannot go on as before. We need fundamental change. And this is where today's guest comes into play. First of all, she's an astronaut, in limbo though, waiting to redeem her ticket to Mars. She's also a quantum biologist, and she's currently setting up a project to get our civilization ready for a completely new future. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Adriana Murray. Are you ready?
Yeah, sure. Well, I hope this is good enough. At some point, I will invest in a big microphone like yours. Not yet.
It's all good. So, Adriana, you do have an impressive biography, and you know that, of course. You have a background in physics. You do have a huge interest when it comes to understanding the origins of life and where we come from, where everything comes from. But what really popped into my eye was when you describe yourself as an aspiring extraterrestrial. So, Adriana, could you elaborate a little bit here? Because this is definitely a very unique self-description in the row of interviews I've been doing here. So please go ahead. What is an aspiring extraterrestrial?
Thanks, Marcus. A real pleasure to be chatting with you. So I think I've given some thought as to what makes humans uniquely human if we kind of compare ourselves to other species. And in one word, I would say that's aspiration. So this capability to strive, this capability to imagine something more or something more expansive or wider or than the current reality that we find ourselves in. So I think every human then, of course, by that definition that I propose, will have aspirations of whatever sort, which is unique to every person. So mine come from a mysterious place because they seem to have been with me most of my life. And that is the belief almost that I will live to explore worlds beyond the current planet that we live on, Earth. So, of course, Mars has become the planet that I'm associated with, I suppose. But even I feel that's even limiting my prospects. So I think just the exploration of new worlds, whatever that means, I mean, that can be figurative. For me, it's kind of physical. Mars is certainly a necessary stepping stone to get further out into the solar system. And of course, beyond the solar system, if we really want to consider ourselves a species that has graduated beyond, you know, surviving in our home planet or home solar system, that's the ultimate goal. But yeah, aspiring to explore worlds beyond the one that we find ourselves on.
Wow. Before we go into that and before we leave the planet with you in the course of this show, let's go back a little in time. Let's go back to where everything came into being. Let's talk a little bit about your education, how everything came together. So when was it when you first knew that your interest for the topics you just mentioned would need to become a reality?
the belief that I would somehow explore other worlds was quite an early envisaging, like when I was 5 years old or something like that. Then, yeah, that remained with me through high school. So I almost didn't remember this massive paper mache project that I did on settlements on Mars when I was 14. So actually my mom dug that out of the family photo album and said, well, actually your recent talk has not changed much since 1997 because you're still talking about power systems, water systems, agricultural systems and community living in the sense of, you know, what does it take to set up a community elsewhere? So that was through high school. Yeah, I've always been quite academically inclined, found school quite easy, quite boring, I might say, because I wasn't able to delve deeply into the topics that interested me, but was like forced to sit there. I think I'm not alone in thinking of being forced to sit in a chair at school is a bit much. So when I left school, I wanted to study jazz, in fact. So this just shows how your purpose in life, you can feel as though you're going off on a tangent, but somehow you come back. So I didn't get into the jazz program because amongst the 9 or 10, I think, subjects I did at school, I did every subject that I could fit into with even after school subjects. Music wasn't one of them. So anyway, then I had to take my second choice, which was physics. Because I thought if I'm going to spend my time in university, again, stuck in a chair, it better be something that sounds very hard. So I thought, reading through the description of the physics courses, I thought, well, I have no idea really what that means. So that's a good thing to spend my time doing. So I studied physics, still with ideas of becoming an astronaut then and not a jazz musician. And then went down the path of becoming fascinated with quantum physics. So besides the rest of the science that we had been taught, which almost felt like quite external to the student or the learner, you know, this is science that's been established hundreds, if not more, years ago. It hasn't changed. This is the same textbook, the same ideas since Newton or whatever. Suddenly we find quantum physics where there seems to be some role for the observer, some role for the human, in fact, in terms of designing the experiments, which can then, you know, the question that you ask can influence the answer, the apparatus can influence what you measure and so on. So this, finally, I found a part of science where I felt like I could make a contribution meaningfully as a human mind.
At what age was that?
So I went, I left school at 17, thankfully, and went to Cape Town and did my undergraduate there from then 17 till 21. So around my first and second year, I didn't really attend much. So finally, I pulled myself together third and fourth. Yeah, and then became fascinated with this quantum physics idea. Yeah.
And your first degree was theoretical physics. Then you did a master's in quantum cryptography, right?
Yes. So after doing 4 years, then I went traveling for 2 years, lived in England for a bit, and then lived in Japan for a longer time. Did bartending and teaching English and those kind of things.
Bartending?
Yeah, actually, that's another interesting story because...
So what would a physicist do other than bartending?
Yeah, so I think I trained as a cocktail bartender, so that's always a useful skill, whatever planet you're on. And actually ended up working in a nightclub, which turned out to be owned by Yakuza. So that was a deep dive into the cultural back alleys of Japan. I was a bit of Japanese, but then thought, no, I need to get back to some rigorous contribution to life instead of, you know, traveling as essentially enjoying other people's cultures and learning and so on, but not like contributing. So I thought, no, I need to get some rigor back in my life. So I returned to South Africa to do a master's in quantum cryptography.
Why quantum cryptography?
Actually, my mom called me. I think it was 2 a.m. She just called whenever without thinking about the time zone. But of course, I was awake. So she said she's just read an article that a professor has moved to South Africa from Germany, Italy background. And that's Professor Francesco Petruccioni, who established the quantum research group in Durban, the biggest and only primarily quantum group in Africa. She said he's been given a huge budget, and if I want to come back, then now's maybe a good time to look into that. So this is a...
So you did it for your mom.
This is a smart plan on her behalf, but he did have positions open for students. So then I got involved in what was a topic in the group at the time, which was looking at the proofs of the security of protocols using quantum physics for information security.
And it turned out to be ever more useful. Look at quantum cryptography these days. I mean, like, this is a super hot topic.
Yeah, so that was a wise recommendation off of supervisors, because indeed this turned out to be the first commercialized quantum technology. Quantique, for example, Geneva, Switzerland are selling these technologies already. So, yeah.
Wow, fascinating. And then your PhD, what was that all about?
Yeah, so then...
The quantum stayed the same,
the quantum
right?
was still there. This was a field that supervisors and the group had been involved with before, and that is the application of quantum physics to biological systems. Seems like a natural direction of thought that, you know, if the world is fundamentally quantum mechanical, then can we use quantum theory to try to understand life? So this was not a new question. Schrödinger famously wrote the book called What is Life in the early days of quantum physics in the first few decades of the 1900s. And yeah, this is still a question we haven't managed to answer. Life probably is quantum, but we haven't quite put our finger on it in terms of a definition of life. Or perhaps if we refer to Feynman's statement that, you know, if you can claim to truly understand something, then you have to be able to build it from scratch. So in terms of us not having been able so far to create life from scratch in a laboratory scenario, then by implication, we have not yet understood life itself. And we're still in that position now.
Right.
But in the end, my study of quantum biology brought me back to the question of, you know, what kind of environments does life emerge in? And that's the field of like quantum astrobiology, which I tried to work in. I don't know if the field exists. Maybe I coined it. I hope someone else is also working on that. Mm-hmm. But the idea that we can use quantum physics to try to understand how the precursors of life can emerge in fairly hostile environments like interstellar molecular clouds in space.
During your PhD, it was fairly clear to you that your main interest would gravitate around the question where life comes from, around the origin of life. Is that right?
Yeah, so I suppose I've always just tried to get to the bottom of things. I think there are a lot of mysteries about the reality that we find ourselves in, and some people are...
If the others can do it, you have to do it yourself.
Yeah, or even some people may be satisfied with some level of explanation, but I'm one of those irritating children that hasn't grown up that's always like, but why? Well, what's the next level? And in the end, it's like, how did the Big Bang, you know, result in the complexity that we see here on Earth, and has it happened in other locations too? That's the big question. And if we can't really explain how physics resulted in chemistry, which resulted in life, looking from an Earth perspective, you know, maybe we need some more data points. Maybe we need to find examples of life elsewhere to fill in the pieces of the puzzle of who we are and where we come from.
Do you have a theory for the origin of life? A personal theory you are ready to share?
Yeah, I think there's so many layers. So I suppose if we were in a physics dinner party, then I would give a physics kind of explanation. But then, of course, if you're in another kind of environment, then you have to also address the question of consciousness, which is something physicists would typically steer away from because that's like outside of the realms of science, just because of our lack of understanding of it within the current scientific paradigm. But I think both of these are valid and probably interconnected. You know, perhaps consciousness emerges from complexity in biology at some point. But I think certainly our ability to derive chemistry from physics means if we want to work in the current scientific paradigm, then these are the problems we need to understand. You know, there's hydrogen produced in the Big Bang. Then we get molecules like H2, the most simple one. Then we get H2O, which we know is a very important medium for life to evolve in, at least on Earth. Some kind of liquid is probably required. H2O seems to have done the job here. And then we look at, you know, how do the amino acids form in this liquid pool? And then, you know, this would be the approach that I would take. But in fact, at some points I realized we don't have enough computing power to work out the answers to these questions. Like it baffled my mind how complex the H2 calculation was. And then I found some articles claiming that the abundance of H2 is not accounted for by any theory. So we haven't even really completely understood how hydrogen molecules form. the observed abundance doesn't correspond completely to the theory of how H2 forms. So the reason for that is that we think H2 forms on the surfaces of icy grains. So the way that they stick together is because they're located on some sticky surface like an ice. But then it's a dirty ice grain, and the impurities within that ice grain actually contribute to the ability of H2 to form. And so it becomes quite complicated, even at 4 Kelvin or whatever you would assume the temperature to be, depending what region of space. Yeah, it takes quite a while on your laptop just to do that. So I thought, well, once we get to these strings that are like the precursors of nucleobases and whatever, then you've got to have time on a supercomputer. You've got to wait for a quantum computer. And I thought, well, am I going to sit around waiting for a quantum computer so that I can finally calculate the answer to my question, like how do these molecules form? Or, and that's a crazy assumption, but it might be true, is it easier to actually go to Mars myself and look for evidence of life and find that data point? And that's an interesting question, like which is easier, getting to Mars or building a quantum computer that's capable of calculating the kind of things we hope to calculate?
Interesting. So last year, Google announced quantum supremacy. So is this quantum computer you're waiting for already in existence, or are you waiting for the next iteration?
Yeah, there's a Twitter account that I follow, the Quantum Bullshit Detector, which is
You mean like it's a good marketing thing?
No, it's a great account. I think the jury's not out yet on who actually runs the account. But you can follow that account if you want to know which of these announcements by the big companies are kind of close to the reality from the perspective of research or not. But there were some objections to whether or not the Google machine could actually outperform, the Google quantum machine could actually outperform the best supercomputers. Perhaps we're close to that now. Arguably, we've surpassed it or not, but we're around there. But this is not good enough, no. So the problem with, so what quantum biology teaches us is that a single electron and even the spin of a single electron can influence a whole chain of events that has an outcome of relevance for the biological system. So that can actually be the life or death of the cell can be determined to a large extent by something as tiny, relatively speaking, as the spin of a single electron. So what that means is that whenever you're trying to calculate something in a biological system, not only do you have to deal with room temperature, because presumably the biological system is alive, not only do you have to deal with the high temperatures, the often sort of messy, liquidy environment in which the cell is and so on, you've also got to take into account every single particle and every single quantum property of every particle. So very soon your space of parameters blows up into something that is not tractable.
So if I read your biography right, at some point you decided you do not want to wait for the arrival of the quantum computer and you rather go to shoot for Mars, right?
Yeah, that's an interesting poll question. Which will come first, humans on Mars or the scalable quantum computer?
Let's make this poll, guys. What do you think? Which one will come first? Quantum computers beyond the bullshit scale or humans on Mars? We would totally love to see what you think. Please find a link to the online poll in our show notes. On with the show. And you took the Mars bifurcation.
Yeah, I think especially during the lockdown, it's been quite encouraging to see that the space industry is kind of full steam ahead, all systems go, because we have, excitingly, next month, NASA and the Chinese Space Agency launching their rovers to Mars. We've got the UAE next month launching their HOPE mission to orbit around Mars, which is the first attempt by the UAE to send something to Mars. We've seen India a few years ago be successful in their first attempt to send a mission to Mars in orbit. So we hope that the UAE is also successful now in their first attempt. Yeah, so it's a busy time for Mars. And of course, the SpaceX launch, I suppose, was a moment for people to feel positive during this era that we find ourselves in 2020.
But you'd totally be down to hopping on one of those rovers because you wanted to be on the Mars One mission, right? You applied for that mission. And so how did that come into being?
Yeah, so I remember the day I read that article and kind of all of my whole life's work kind of flashed before my eyes as I read the headline of the newspaper. And I thought, oh, this is it. I didn't quite get my head around like that I would actually travel to Mars in the foreseeable future with a project that had just been announced in the newspaper. I thought it'd be more complex or long-winded than that. which turns out to be correct because, of course, the Mars One project announced bankruptcy last year. So it's not as easy as stating a one-way trip to cut costs and then going ahead and doing it. But this was a success, I would say, despite the bankruptcy announcement last February. The Mars One project, to me, was really a success and may still generate funding. We'll have to wait and see. Mm-hmm. But Lisa Simpson volunteered for the Mars One project on The Simpsons. Sheldon Cooper volunteered for the Mars One project on The Big Bang Theory. Cartman volunteered for Mars on South Park. So those are like my three favorite shows. So to see the project that I'm a part of mentioned directly in my favorite TV shows was like, well, this is success.
I think it's important to know that this is a one-way mission. So there's no return ticket. But so at some point you applied to be part of that mission. And how did that all turn out?
So the project began in around 2012, I think. And then in 2013, we applied in the first round. So around 200,000 applications were received by the Mars One project.
200,000.
And I met lots of people who wished they'd heard about it. So perhaps if they'd kept the applications open for longer and marketed for longer, they would have had even more. But of course, not everyone was completely serious in the applications, but we had to answer some psychological questions around how we deal with stressful situations, what kind of character we believe ourselves to have, how we integrate with others then with that character, questions like that about more like team dynamics and extreme environments. Then a video of ourselves where we had to tell a joke and other things, I guess, to get a sense of our actual personalities and how we come across.
Humor.
And then after the subsequent rounds, we had a medical exam with our own doctor. Being a startup, of course, they couldn't afford to, you know, send doctors to all around the world. So we did it.
200,000 people.
Yeah, exactly. And then finally, it was narrowed down to 100 people. That was in 2015. I am one of those 100.
Guys, to be chosen from among 200,000 participants is more than mind-boggling. 200,000 people. I mean, like, that's half of all the people officially estimated to have participated in the Apollo program. But for Mars One, we're talking potential astronauts, settlers, Martians, or whatever you call them only. Damn it. I'd tap on my own shoulder if I was one of them.
So we still keep in touch through email and so on and on social media as the Mars 100. So many are still hopeful that the founders of the project will raise the money. Discussions with investors are ongoing, is the latest update. So yeah, there's no need for me to withdraw from that program. As I said, I believe it's been a success in terms of storytelling. And if investments are raised, of course, then that's still an option. Yeah, but in fact, the declaration of bankruptcy in 2019 inspired me to leave my...
That was a bummer.
Well, it inspired me to leave my job in the corporate world and establish Proudly Human. So it was a positive realization for me that why on earth would I rely on a startup, a great and bold proposal, but basically by two guys who I really enjoyed chatting with and sharing ideas with. But essentially, why not do that myself?
Proudly Human is, if I understand the project right, is not least designed to getting us ready to leave Earth, to leave the planet, because it's designed to find out in how far we can live a sustainable life in almost uninhabitable places. So how and why did you come up with that idea of Proudly Human? By the way, I totally like the title.
Thanks. Yeah, the title emerged. I was doing an interview at an astrobiology conference in Chicago, and I can't remember how it went, but I said, I'm Adriana Marais, and I'm partly human. They said, what? You're partly human? I said, no, proudly human. And then everyone laughed so much that that really stuck in my mind. I thought, proudly human, that's what I meant, of course.
That's good.
So that was Proudly Human. That was 2015, actually, when I first put those words together. Mm-hmm. So yes, as you describe, we are interested in testing the bounds of human capability through technology and through community spirit in the most extreme environments on Earth. But I would add to what you said that we're not only endeavoring to prepare to leave Earth, rather we are investigating living with each other, living in harmony with each other and the environment, no matter how extreme. So I think what we do towards space exploration always has an impact on Earth, but I think this perhaps has to be overt, so even intentional.
So it's difficult to justify developing things for space in the current paradigm, growing inequality, lack of access to resources for so many, especially in the context where I am in South Africa. We have, after the pandemic, shocking levels of unemployment, which will only get worse, increasing inequality. So from the perspective of a South African, it's felt imperative to me that the inspirational power of space exists, but there has to be a direct link with impact on Earth. So in fact, what we would like to do is learn from cultures that have adapted to live in extreme environments, of course, use technology to adapt and become resource efficient in these environments. But we believe this is a future on Earth that we need to take into account also. Things are not going to get easier on Earth. So the number of people who already live in what we consider extreme environments is only going to increase. So, in fact, our proposal is exactly whatever planet we're on, we need to learn to live with a higher level of resource efficiency in harmony with each other and the environment.
So where's the difference to prior projects, similar projects like Mars 500 or Biosphere 1 and 2? So where's the difference?
Yeah, so I was really happy to meet with three of the members of the Biosphere 2 team in Bali. They're currently running the Biosphere Foundation from there, where they have a lot of activity with young people, so school children and others come in to do projects and really learn more about the natural environment, protecting it and integrating into it, living in harmony with it. So it was fantastic to meet these people who really lived inside that dome for 2 years, and they're advisors for Proudly Human. So when it comes to team selection, team size, and the other challenges and successes of the Biosphere 2 project, we'll certainly learn from as we go forward. So how do we compare to that? I would say we are proposing something more unique in that we would like to not simulate life on Mars. So we're not going to do like the high seas project in Hawaii, where we delay communications with the ground control artificially, where we have suits that are of no real use in Hawaii, but that we put on artificially to simulate what life on Mars will be like. Our objectives are broader, let's say, in terms that we will arrive in a truly extreme environment and try to do in situ resource utilization in that environment to as large an extent as possible. So, 3D printing didn't even exist in the 90s. So the Biosphere 2 project had to be obviously constructed and so on before the project kicked off. In contrast to that, we plan to arrive to a remote location and set up our infrastructure, utilize the environmental resources in the location to as large an extent as possible, and try to live in harmony with the environment and each other in that extreme environment. So what kind of environments are we considering? The hottest place on Earth. So the hottest place on average on Earth is in the Dalol deserts in Ethiopia. This is because the heat doesn't only come from above, it comes from below. There's geothermal activity there. So in the day, you can expect like 50 degrees Celsius, and at night, it doesn't get much better because of the heat coming from below, like the high 30s.
Wow.
So the reason we're interested in this location with respect to Mars, which you may say the temperature on Mars is cold, so why do you need to go to the hottest place on Earth? Because in that environment, we'd like to look at solar power. We'd like to look at 3D printing from sand. We'd like to look at the very arid conditions and growing crops, etc., on a very tight water budget, let's say, and all of those aspects of living there. So, of course, there are also people living in this region of Ethiopia. So, when people think of going to Mars, they often imagine arriving to a place where there's no one, which will only be the situation for the first people to get there. After that, it will always be the situation that you arrive on a planet where there is a group of people who spent a lot of time and effort evolving and creating a culture that can survive that environment. So interfacing with existing cultural habits and methodologies and practices is going to be a part of adapting to extreme environments beyond Earth, unless you're the first team. So this is going to be an interesting, hopefully, cultural exchange between the Afar people in that region, who we will have to interface with to get permission and so on. So, yeah, we obviously locked down currently, at least in South Africa, still. So as soon as we can travel again, that's the next step, to do a location scout in that area, decide exactly where the project could work. Other environments: Antarctica, the coldest place on Earth. So at the Vostok Russian base, the coldest ever recorded temperatures around negative 90 degrees Celsius.
Let's make a quick break here, as Lake Vostok bears an incredibly interesting story. I immediately remembered when Adriana mentioned the name Vostok. So, for those who have not heard about Lake Vostok before, the lake is one of several hundred subglacial lakes under the massive ice sheet covering Antarctica. Now listen carefully, my friends. The ice cap above the surface of the lake measures 4,000 meters, that is 4 kilometers of massive ice. The lake measures 250 kilometers in length and makes it the 16th largest lake in the world. Scientists estimate that the water has been isolated for between 20 to 25 million years down there, making it an incredibly pure and untouched body of water. If only the Russians had left it untouched. On February 5, 2012, a team of Russian scientists completed the longest ever ice core of 3,768 meters and pierced the ice shield to the surface of the lake. A heartbreaking moment to me, considering the fact that kerosene was used to keep the borehole from freezing. But hey, perhaps I'm just nitpicking here with no sense for real exploration. Back to Adriana.
So as you go inland in Antarctica, the temperatures are really comparable to Mars in midwinter. So negative 60, negative 70 are kind of average temperatures for winter. The Concordia station is another one, the French-Italian station inland. So this is a perfect location on Earth to test technology at these low temperatures. Of course, very dry air and so on. So environmentally, this is quite closely analogous to the environment that we expect on Mars. But the isolation is another really important aspect of the Antarctic environment. So this is the only place on Earth, as far as I know, that once you're there for the winter, you cannot leave for between 4 and 8 months, depending on the weather. No ship can crack through the ice. No pilot can be expected to risk their life to come and land in the darkness and the wind. So you're there for the duration of the mission. You need to rely on the infrastructure that you've brought with you and the team that you've brought with you.
What's the difference to what the crew at McMurdo Station is already experiencing?
Yeah, there's so much to learn, of course, from the decades of legacy that we've had in, well, a century, almost, what is it now, more than a century, of course, of exploration in Antarctica. But what we will do actually harks back to the original missions. So if you look at the Shackleton Hut and the Scott Expedition, they built their own house. So this is not unprecedented. Maybe, you know, modern humans have become quite used to their comfort zones. So now people will travel to Antarctica. It's very harsh, very dark, very isolated. But they arrive to a very happy, cozy infrastructure that's been tested and weathered for decades and probably functions quite well. And there's people there who've been there before. So our plan, again, is to arrive in an isolated environment with our infrastructure on tow. So by boat, of course, across the ocean and then over land. So we really set everything up from scratch. So this is dangerous to do in the middle of nowhere, of course, at negative 60 or 70. You can't afford for anything to go wrong. But our idea is to set up the infrastructure nearby to another overwintering base and really test our capability to arrive, set up infrastructure, survive with what we've brought, using the existing resources around us to as large an extent as possible, and hopefully develop a sense of community spirit, a sense of enjoyment, a sense of purpose, a sense of cohesion. These are equally as important as the technology functioning for the success of the mission.
Will you be part of the first crew?
For Mars or for all of them, I'd say yes, yes.
For Proudly Human, either in the desert or in Antarctica. So will you be watching on the monitors or will you be watching from within the field?
No, there's no fun in that. No, I will definitely be there doing the scouts beforehand, probably helping with shipping ahead of the arrival of the rest of the crew. So once we prepare for the actual expedition, we'll have all of our equipment there, but we'll really go through the whole process of Then it's analogous to arriving on Mars, where you arrive in a desolate location. You've hopefully planned correctly and brought all the correct equipment along. Mm-hmm. You set up your infrastructure. You try to be as circular as possible. With only 10 people, it's not yet an economy, I guess, but this is also an interesting demo of what kind of system you can evolve, where resources are the primary focus. So not wealth or any other, you know, financial model that we currently kind of live by.
Motivations.
But resources. So this will be the primary goal is to manage resources as efficiently as possible and have as much fun as possible at the same time.
Wow. So you mentioned that this could sort of be a future blueprint for life on Earth also. So not only for life on Mars, but also how we can live a sustainable life on Earth. So if you could paint a picture of the future you're envisioning on Earth based on your vision with Proudly Human, what would that future look like? Would such a base be a blueprint to be sort of applied like a franchise all over the place globally? How would you picture that?
I think we have to comment on some basics. The first one being that we've lived in the illusion of infinite resources for far too long. You know, we've been able to pack up and move to another area since the days when we were living in caves. You know, presumably when the firewood in one area ran out, we'd move to another and probably go back to the original area when the wood was replenished, etc. But now, due to population growth and our expansion over the whole surface of the planet, the habitable part of the planet, it's becoming painfully obvious that resources are not infinite, and that this attitude and this approach that there'll always be more and that we won't run out is going to lead to our extinction if we carry on along this path for much longer. Yeah, the disruption of the biosphere. You know, people talk about climate change, but a few degrees of increase in temperature is just the tip of the iceberg. We're also living in the midst of an extinction event. We're destroying the natural environment at a higher rate than ever before. So I'd put that all in a statement that we are destabilizing our life support system by the rate at which we are extracting resources. It's not sustainable. So people talk about sustainable technologies, and I'm still not sure exactly what that means, because there's no such thing as an infinitely sustainable system. But certainly what we're doing now is not sustainable. That's quite clear. So I think it's a natural move. I don't want to say away from the current profit-driven, consumerist, growth-driven model, but rather we need to reflect on whether this model still serves us. Is this materialistic, this obsession with materialism, is it going to serve us going forward? And I think when we look at the fact that we've got a finite set of resources on this planet, we've got a growing population with growing requirements for multiple devices, etc. Yeah, something's going to give at some point. Maybe we're already in the beginning of that. So it's got to have a focus on resource efficiency, but more fundamentally in culture, I think. The culture of believing that we aspire towards some materialistic goal has to be done away with. It's no longer serving us. It's no longer possible for all of us to, in harmony with each other and the environment, also have aspirations of such a gross amount of materialistic possessions and so on. So,
what kind of role does COVID-19 play in all of this? Are we experiencing a watershed moment, or is this just a precursor to something else, or are we going back to normal?
Yes, I think it's a wake-up call and an opportunity, which is up to us how we take it forward. So there's obviously a number of paths that are open to us. And on the one hand, this pandemic has made us all feel very anxious and uncertain and powerless. You know, we don't have the power to vaccinate. We don't have the power to get out of our homes. We don't have the power to travel. So it's kind of removed our power. So there's this uncertainty and this lack of agency that's seemingly the undercurrent here. But I would now claim that that's not the way that we should look at it. We should rather see it as an opportunity to reflect and an opportunity to reestablish our agency. This is the time. Right now we have this opportunity to decide which direction we take from here. I think we do have way more power than we imagine in terms of influencing the way this turns out. And yeah, our increasingly technology-driven lives, you know, we often feel that we lack agency, that things are happening with or without us, and that we have no power to change them. But I think if we sit and reflect, the only positive choice to make is to believe that we have the power to change things and to try our best to do that. And now is a great circuit breaker opportunity to go out into the world and say, I'm not going to do things the same as I did them before, and hopefully influence people around us to also think and do things differently. So that could mean many things for different people. Some people have lost their jobs, which is terrible, but also an opportunity to think about how to approach life from now on. I personally went down into a valley, and me and my partner built a cabin off-grid. So we, in the same model as Proudly Human, we arrived in an area with no infrastructure, very beautiful, very isolated, no road. And we had to carry all of the stuff down, and we built a cabin, which we mm-hmm. lived in for almost 2 months or more than 2 months, mm-hmm. where we set up everything from scratch. So there's wow. always an opportunity to learn. And I think trying to understand, what do we need to be happy? Can we do more with less? What are the basic requirements for me to do what I feel I need to do in this life?
So it's in fact to rediscover one's own roots and to rediscover the need to resonate with whatever we touch or do. So it's in fact an issue that we lost connectivity to our environment. And I think what you're saying here is that we need to rediscover that connection by building our own shelter and by finding our own food. Is that right?
Yeah, so I think we needed to have this era of science and technology where we believed our superiority over the rest of nature because we're able to wield the power of the resources around us and shape our environment. I think that was a necessary part of the process, but I think now we've reached the end point of that trajectory. We now need to realize that in the midst of all of our discoveries about how the world works, we need to go back, as exactly you say, to realizing our connection with everything around us. You know, there's no such thing as a single living organism. Every single example of life had an origin of parents or whatever organism you're studying, and indeed relies on a massive network of other living systems for survival and sustenance. So, yeah, if our science has taught us anything, I hope it can also reveal this to us, that we are interconnected and fundamentally reliant and interconnected on every atom through to molecule through to living system on this planet, whether it's the bacteria in our stomachs or the plants producing the oxygen that we breathe, etc. So that's a more philosophical point to ponder on the connectivity of everything. So how does that translate into everyday life? I think, yeah, that's about appreciating resources, appreciating our role in the network. It's less about the individual and kind of the interconnectivity between everything. And in a simple way, that means, do you know where your water comes from? Do you know where your water goes? Do you know where your food comes from? Is something people are working towards now with blockchain enabling you to know where your steak came from or whatever. This is a direction which I think we need to move faster in, which is this understanding of our consumption, trying to reduce that to some extent, and trying to be sustainable in our homes. That starts in the home to as large an extent as we can. And understanding where our resources come from, and then perhaps trying to minimize our consumption thereof.
So are you still looking for applicants?
Yeah, we haven't announced yet, but thanks for asking. We will actually be building a database of the kind of people who would be prepared to up and go for 6 months to an extreme location. A skilled individual, not necessarily in science and technology only, because your research project or your inquiry while you're there could be on any level. You know, we're going to need chefs, we're going to need psychologists, we're going to need fitness instructors,
doctors
of course. So the doctors and the engineers and the scientists to keep the infrastructure running would be essential, but for the rest, you know, this is up to the people to propose what they would contribute to a community. So I'd say in the next 5 years we hope to tick off Ethiopia and Antarctica, perhaps also under the ocean, but we'll see how they go. But those are the three categories that we want to do. And we will be building a database, so of people's skills, qualifications, and proposals for the kind of projects that they would want to run. I mean, an idea we're playing with now is to build a ground station, a satellite ground station in Ethiopia, whereby we'd have a business model to build a data center and all the associated infrastructure with the ground station, but also then to be able to generate revenue, not for us, but for the location in which we leave the infrastructure. So Proudly Human is not interested in making profit, but we are interested in the livelihoods of the people that we interact with. So this is one such proposal. Another would be to set up solar arrays that would be of use to people there, perhaps medical infrastructure, you name it. So we don't want it to be arrive and pop up and leave. We want to meaningfully contribute going forward to each location.
How would people be able to apply? And where?
Yeah, so please go check out our Proudly Human website, where there's some more detail besides what I've said now on our objectives and our ideology. And there's a place to send a mail there to leave your details. But otherwise, I would say follow me or Proudly Human on social media, because we will announce widely when we start collecting this database of potential applicants who would be on hand, let's say, for either a mission to Mars or to Antarctica or wherever, these kind of people who have a passion for what they do and a purpose for what they would contribute. So yeah, please leave your details on the Proudly Human website or follow us on social media, where we will make an announcement probably this year, because even without a date in mind, I think it's really important to collect this team of like-minded people with all sorts of different skills that we can then try to collate into the teams that we need for each respective project, which will have, you know, different objectives and requirements depending on the location.
There's one interesting thing I would like to add here, that you are also trying to go beyond the monetary, the capitalist system, even for your own project. So your own project focuses more on partnering as opposed to investing large sums of money. Is that right?
Yes. Yeah. Thanks for bringing that up. So yeah, I suppose partially informed by the lack so far of success of the Mars One project to attract investors for the large amounts that they required, we'd like to do a more collaborative approach. So we envisage a better future, whatever planet we're on. And that's very broad. And of course, I can't manage that kind of thing myself. But the idea is for the Proudly Human hashtag, let's say, to resonate in many projects, enabling a collaborative, more partnership-based, as you say, approach. So, for example, we've just recently got the go-ahead to put one of our habitats in the Cape Town Science Center. Our habitat has been donated. Our water, atmospheric water extraction system is going to be donated. Our solar array will be donated. Our IoT monitoring all of these systems, dashboard and so on the front of the habitat will be donated. And at the same time, we'll have a whole bunch of children, once the science center opens again, coming through and playing in this habitat. We're going to paint it like a Martian environment. And this is kind of our phase zero. So this is an example. And I think in the lockdown, it's even more difficult to attract actual investments, depending on where you're looking. So even more imperative for people to partner in win-win contexts in terms of achieving goals for all. So we exchange a marketing opportunity, visibility in terms of inspirational, we hope, project to get the equipment visible to the public, to inspire kids to start thinking about how they might want to contribute going forward to this kind of technology or community. And yeah, so we're hopefully moving ahead in terms of attracting the kind of partners who are not looking for financial exchange, but rather for win-win trade exchanges.
Adriana, thank you so much. We do have a little tradition here on our show, and this show is called Space Cafe Podcast. And usually when you go to coffee places, you would perhaps sometimes love to have an espresso. And this, and our little tradition here, is called Space Espresso. And a Space Espresso is a quick shot of a space-related story that pops into your mind without much thinking. So what's your favorite story when it comes to space, a space-related story you would like to share with us right now?
Okay, I can share a story. I was really, really excited to be in Mexico at the International Astronautical Congress when Elon Musk announced SpaceX's plans to get to Mars for the first time publicly. But that's not the topic of the story. So there was a very exclusive Lockheed Martin dinner that you had to have a special invite to get into. So some other friends and I decided we're going to try and sneak into this party because they're astronauts there and we really have to talk to these people. So we were hanging around outside the door and we saw two spots at a table. So it could be that only two of us would sneak in. You know, those were the chairs we were going to aim for. So we waited for a moment and then we both just sort of walked in very naturally and sat down at the table. So in these two empty chairs, there was what I thought was a glass of white wine. So I took a big sip of the white wine to, you know, relax and acclimatize, realized it was tequila. And then I turned to the person next to me and sort of with watering eyes. And he said, "What do you think of when you look up at the night sky?" And I said, "I don't know, I feel about the tequila." I said, "A sense of belonging." And he turned out to be a cosmonaut and we had a great chat after that. But yeah, what do you think of when you look up at the night sky? And suddenly popped out of my head a sense of belonging. So I think for those of us who feel a sense of belonging with what is beyond what we are used to here on the surface of Earth, it's great to get together at these big congresses and get to interact and talk to people who've actually been to space, and they get to share their wisdom with people like me who are dreaming
of
that.
Wow. That's definitely one of the top stories we've ever heard on this show. So thank you so much for sharing.
Thanks to Lucky Martin for the free tequila.
Yeah. And for the open doors. Thank you so much. So, dear listeners, that was a super fun and inspiring show we had today with Adriana. And if you guys would like to learn more about Adriana, please do go to our website where we have a bunch of information about Adriana, of course, a bunch of links to her work. And if you would like to share your ideas or your questions with us, please do get in touch with us by email. The email is podcast@spacewatch.global. And other than that, Adriana, thank you so much for taking the time. That was super inspiring. And we will definitely keep an eye on you and the fascinating Proudly Human project. And other than that, thank you again for taking the time. It was really, really fun talking with
Thanks.
You. That's very inspiring.
Thanks so much, Marcus. Really enjoyed the questions and chatting with you. Thanks for the opportunity.